Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Case 37 is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who could administer the poison? Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse, one call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at last, the child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. So I want to welcome those of you who came last night for our Sesshin, and I want to thank you for sitting so well, so deeply this morning. Those long morning sits are really wonderful. Everybody who's been here for a couple of days, you know, have been coming into the Dokusan room with really deep, deep engagement with their koans. You know. So thank you all very much. This koan appears to make almost no sense at all. So let's go through it a little bit more. Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said, all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? See? So these are two awakened teachers, and one is saying to the other, you know, a Buddhist teaching is that all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on. See, that's the basic teaching. And Guishan asked Yangshan, how would you prove it? How would you prove it? Now, you know, that doesn't really seem like an urgent question. You know, it's like, huh? You know, this sounds like an abstruse teaching of Buddhist philosophy. But it's actually very, very important. If you think back on your life as far as you can remember back, you know, at every stage in your life, you know, I'm willing to be stand corrected, but I would say that at every stage in your life, the world has seemed to be real to you, right? A year ago, you know, my reality seemed pretty real to me, right? I was driving to work and my clutch started to fail. And I have an old car that has a clutch, a manual clutch. So most people don't know what that is anymore. But you know, to shift gears, you actually have to use your hand. You have to depress the clutch on the floor. There's a clutch pedal. And you depress the clutch pedal, to take to disengage the engine, basically, from the gears, and then you shift up or down, you know. So if you're slowing down, you have to actually shift down into a lower gear, and if you're speeding up, you shift into an upper gear. And there's this moment where you disengage the engine from the turning wheels, really, and you shift. See, when your clutch is going, you shift into a higher gear, but the car doesn't go any faster. It's like the wheels are turning, but it's not in. The engine's revving, but it's not engaging with the drive shaft, I guess. So the car isn't doing anything. It, you know, you're revving and revving, but there's like this missing. The energy is not transferring into fast speeding of your car. And when that can, your clutch can go really fast. Right. I mean, suddenly you can be unable to drive, like you can be unable to get up a hill. And, you know, I just, you know, basically said a little prayer, not to anybody in particular, but I just had to get to Rutgers, you know, so I could teach my classes. And I made it, you know, I got it. And at the end of the day, I called GT Automotive on Woodbridge Avenue, and I drove it up, you know, just made it into their parking lot and replaced the clutch. So, you know, that's reality, right? That's reality. You know, 10 years earlier, you know, this happened, and that seemed like reality. And so you can go back in your life, and at every stage, it seemed like reality. You know, when you were a kid, it's, you know, it looking back on your childhood world now, it can seem somewhat unreal to you, right? It probably does seem a little bit unreal to you, right? And we say, well, you know, they're just kids, but what does that really mean? You know, for you as a child, your reality seemed totally real to you, right? And you know, it isn't the reality that parents live in, but it seemed real to, probably seemed real to you as a child. So, you know, I can remember, I've talked about this before, but, you know, I wanted to be, like every other little kid, I wanted to be liked and admired by all the other kids in my class. And I bought I nagged my mother into buying me a lunchbox, a new lunchbox. And the lunchboxes in those days had themes. So you could get a Superman lunchbox, and the lunchbox had Superman on it. And, you know, there was I think there was a Donna Reed lunchbox. I think there was a lunchbox like, you know, Bonanza, you know, you probably don't even know these shows, but they were popular television shows of the late 50s and 60s. And I wanted to be, I was a big fan of this program called Zorro, which was a Walt Disney series about this masked revolutionary in Mexico who fought for the peasants and rode a black horse and was a master swordsman, and he could outfence like 10 people at once, right? And I was in love with Zorro, living in Baltimore, Maryland at the time, which was very far from, you know, exotic, the back, Mexico in the back lots of Walt Disney Studios. So, you know, for me, this was like, you know, he was everything I wasn't. He was daring and mysterious. You know, I was just trying to get to school without getting beaten up. And this, you know, I never missed a show, you know, of Zorro. If you ever have a chance to Google them, they're probably on Tubi or someplace like that. You can probably, Hulu, you can probably watch some of the old episodes. But anyway, I got this lunchbox and I thought, oh, you know, I wasn't consciously thinking, oh, now they'll like me. But, you know, I had this idea, I'm sure, that if I had this lunchbox, it would give me a certain, you know, cachet. And so I brought my new lunchbox to school, and when it was time for lunch, we were all supposed to go into the coat room and get our lunchboxes and bring them back. And the teacher would spread these oilcloth tablecloths on it, and we'd have our lunch, right? And anyway, I was walking, all the kids were already seated, and I grabbed my lunchbox and I walked across the room, and everybody started laughing at me. And I looked around, and it wasn't the response I expected. And I looked, and my thermos was leaking milk. It was a defective thermos, and I was leaving a trail of milk along the floor. It was funny, you know, at least for little kids, you know, in the first grade or kindergarten or something. It was funny, but it was so. When I got home, I was so troubled. It was like, oh, Mom, you know, this is, I couldn't, you know, I was so upset, I couldn't sleep, you know. And, you know, I also used to have, I remember my mother took me to see the movie, the Disney movie, Sleeping Beauty, which some of you may have seen. And there's a witch in there, and I remember after seeing that movie, it was hard for me to go to sleep because I would, you know, I would look over and I would see the witch, you know, her silhouette. And, you know, I'd call for my mother and she'd come up and flip on the light and it was just my coat on the coat rack. But I was so sure it was the witch. You know, as an adult, I can look back and I hardly ever look for witches anymore in my bedroom. But at the time, you know, it seemed so real. You know, so look, where is this going? It's nice to go down memory lane. But it's not an unimportant fact that at every stage in your life, the world you were living in seemed real. And that now when you look back, you realize a lot of what seemed real wasn't real. So you look back at your childhood and you realize, well, who gives a damn about your thermos, you know? And anyway, after first grade, I didn't see any of those kids again, right? Or most of them. So you know, we realize from a certain standpoint that that was unimportant, but at the time it seemed so real and important. You know, I'm sure if you review your past, you can remember, like, you know, having a friend maybe reject you and being totally, totally dejected, right? And just feeling like down for weeks, right? You know, like down in the dumps for weeks. And later you think, oh, you know, who cares, you know? But the fact is that the fact that we can go through our lives and every step feels real, and then looking back, we realize it is unreal, is like not a trivial fact. It should make us think about the reality we live in and realize that it's probably in many ways unreal too, right? If we are lucky enough to continue living, you know, there will be a moment where we look back at the things that we thought of were so gripping, and we realize that was unimportant, that wasn't real, you know. So you know, most people think that they live in reality. They think they live in reality. And that's not an accident, right? You know, the Buddhist view is that our minds are constantly constructing below the surface of our awareness the reality we live in. It's like there is, you know, your senses are taking in all this information, and you know, somehow it all gets organized, right? And it goes, it feeds into this, like, you know, screen that we call reality. And it produces this little show we call reality. And it does it so well that we never suspect that it's a show, that it's a performance. You know, this sounds totally crazy in a certain way, right? It's like, come on, you know, if I burn the beans, you burn the beans, you know, you can't wish that away. That's certainly true, right? Or if you run into a brick wall, you will definitely knock yourself out or break your nose. But all the same, there's something to this idea, right? Every step of our lives, as we're going through our lives, has felt totally real. And when we look back, it's not real. And you say, how is that possible, right? The Buddhist view is it's possible because it's never real. It's not made up of real elements, but the way it all gets combined is never real, right? And we don't see it because below the surface of our consciousness, the process that constructs our reality for us is so good that we don't notice, right? We can't notice. So there's never, you know, you're not going through your day, and all of a sudden you unless you have some real trauma, right? Trauma can do that, right? Something can happen to you and suddenly you look around and there's this powerful sense of unreality, right? And then, you know, you may snap out of it and just go back, but you may never go back, right? That happens to people. You know, they never go back to that reality again, right? Their world is fundamentally changed. But normally we don't encounter things where we just say, oh, and this afternoon I fell into a period of unreality. You know, that just never happens. And that's curious, right? You know, even if you go to another country, like a far distant place where the culture is very different, you know, sometimes people do have a sense of unreality, but our little system that takes all this and makes it seem real is really good at what it does. And yet, you know, when we look back, we see how often our reality has been unreal. And I definitely think that when people, if there are human beings 500 years from now, you know, they're going to look back and say, what the hell were they doing at the end of the 20th century, right? It's like, you know, they cut down all the trees, you know, it's like they did what? You know, they heated up the planet until the polar ice caps melted. You know, what was wrong with them? Didn't they see? And of course, many scientists ask this question too. Many environmental scientists say, you know, there was actually an article in the New York Times about how all these environmental scientists are struggling with depression, right? Because it's like they have these reams of data that nobody's paying attention to. And you know, we treat it like as a problem of just not having the information, but people have the information. It's just our reality doesn't let us sort of take it in, right? So if you say to somebody, you know, basically, and I don't know what decision I would make myself, you know, would you say to somebody, you're not going to be able to have the career you trained for, you know, you're going to have to give that up and you're basically going to have a hand-to-mouth existence, but the environment will be better. You know, most people would go, no way, you know, I want to be successful. I want to use my talents. And you can't blame them. I mean, it's the whole system encourages people to do that, right? So anyway, you know, every once in a while we get hints of the unreality of the way we live. And it, it, you know, it comes in the form of like inconsistencies, right? Where, you know, suddenly we realize, I mean, another example is when I was growing up, everybody smoked cigarettes, right? You know, if you watch one of my favorite movies is Casablanca, right? If you have, my students had, nobody in my class this year, in my poetry class, had seen Casablanca. I couldn't believe it. And I went back and actually watched the movie, and I noticed everybody was smoking all the time. You know, basically, if you look back at those old movies, everybody's smoking. It's like, they're drinking too, drinking and smoking all the time. And of course, like half the people in my family have died of lung cancer and have been smokers. So, you know, when they discovered that cigarettes cause cancer, it was a long time ago, right? You know, as we all know, the tobacco companies worked really hard to keep this from getting out. But you know, actually, when I'm on campus, I see a lot of kids smoking. And I will actually say, you know, I'm just like an old geezer. I'll actually say to somebody, you know, that's not good for you, you know. You know, you'll be sorry, you know, and they probably think, you know, this old man. But, you know, notice that even in the presence of evidence, it's part of like the reality. It's so seductive to, like, smoking is very satisfying. You know, you get a rush of energy, and it's very cool, right? I mean, when you smoke a cigarette, it's like you're smoking death. You know, it's very, very, it's symbolically really interesting, right? You know, I know this is going to kill me, but, you know, it's so, I get such a bang out of it, right? And it's very cool, right? It's very, So anyway, you know, notice how powerful our reality is. It's so powerful, it overrides evidence. And basically, you know, it's so persuasive. It's so all-inclusive, right? So actually, this is what Guishan is getting at, right? Guishan says, you know, the system, the little guy in our heads who organizes all this is so good that we never, you know, we rarely see any inconsistencies. And when we do, we push them out of the way. So how is it ever possible for people to wake up? See, how is it ever possible for people to wake up? You know, the Buddhist view is that human beings are fundamentally Buddha, that consciousness is fundamentally this luminous, enlightened mind, right? And that people are fundamentally compassionate. And you look around and you say, that seems very unrealistic, right? You know, given the way things are. And so, you know, Guishan is saying, how do we, you know, the illusion is so good, it's so thorough, and it's so, you know, how do we ever get people out of it? See, so this is not like an academic question. It's really consequential. It's like, you know, we live in a world that is consistent, right? But it's not reality. It's just all-encompassing and consistent, you know. And, you know, I'm sure many people here saw The Matrix, right? The Matrix was so powerful because it was playing with this idea, right? The idea is that, you know, it's possible to live in a totally simulated world and not be aware of it because it's such a perfect simulation. If you recall, there were just a few moments where the simulation does something weird, like a black cat walks by twice and there's a little shimmer. But Neo, you know, is totally convinced this is real, but he has like this rebellious streak, right? There's something about it that bothers him. And yesterday, in the last couple of days, I've been talking about the fact that, you know, people come to Zen because there's something about reality. They don't know what, right? They don't know what, but there's something about reality that just, you know, doesn't sit well with them. They feel that something is missing from their lives, even though they don't know what it is. And the system is so effective, right? That, you know, people in a way can't know what it is, right? So, you know, you can say, well, what's wrong with your life? You know, you have a good job, you have friends, you have, you know, what's missing? And I don't know, right? But something is saying that, you know, there's something I can't put my finger on, but I'm just missing something, and I don't know what it is. And that's really, in a way, like our saving grace, right? Maybe they have an experience where, you know, it's a tragedy, right? So you see somebody you love die, and you just can't put it down. You can't go back to your everyday life, right? And you might say, what's it all about? Why are we here? Or, you know, if somebody dies, you know, all of these religions will rush in with answers, right? So, you know, if the person dies and you know, that person is in a Abrahamic religion, you'll probably say, well, you know, they're going, that person is in a better place. That person is with the Lord, right? Or with the ancestors. Yeah. In other cultures, there's other, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they would say, oh yes, you know, you're moving on to your next life. And in Hinduism too, right? You're going on to your next incarnation. And, it's interesting, isn't it, that Zen doesn't particularly get into that. It's not that Zen tradition doesn't believe in things like karma and so on. But it doesn't want you to rush to your textbook when somebody dies and say, okay, so if for 49 days you're in the bardo, and then after that you see two people having sex, and you, if you are attracted to the woman, you enter and become a man, and if you're attracted to the man, you enter the womb and you become a woman. That's a classic Buddhist teaching, by the way. Zen says, you know, we have bigger fish to fry, right? We have more important issues than to get caught up in that. Because that too is just a kind of movie that we're watching. We want to see the projector. So Zen's not totally interested in those questions. And Zen would say, you know, when that kind of a tragedy happens, it's a great pity to rush in with an answer, see? It's a great pity. You're really not doing that person any favors. You know, they might feel better, and then they can go back to their regular reality, right? You know, there used to be a professor of Korean at Rutgers who would sit with us, and she had a wonderful son who was like the ideal, this really happened, the ideal son. You know, he was like an, he was a, college honors. He was going to graduate school. He was this super nice kid. I never met him. But he was like a political science major, and he was on a charity bike ride on the interstate in like Montana or something. And you know, he was riding like, you know, whatever they do, like five, you know, these, I have friends who do these charity bike rides. They'll ride 500 miles, right? And it drums up money for a cause. People kick in money, like, you know, for every mile or something, or for every rider, you know. And he was on a interstate highway, and somebody hit him. And the person who hit him was like, was a very screwed up person who had already been, had her license suspended several times, and, you know, was like a shoplifter and this kind of very troubled person. And, you know, anyway, it was like the worst possible thing, right? Here's this, I mean, you can imagine the pain and the how horrible that would be, right? To you know, you have this kid and you're thinking, by God, I've done it. You know, I've actually raised a good kid. And he's, you know, like this highly motivated person. And then he gets, you know, anyway, she called me up and said, would you like to come to talk with us? And I went to talk with her. She said, you know, I'm Korean, so, you know, I was raised in a Christian family. She said, but I'm not a Christian anymore. My husband's not, he's an atheist. And, you know, we asked a Christian to come and talk with us, but we wanted to hear what you had to say. And I, you know, I really had to think about it, because I had to think, should I tell her the story that will make it all right or not? And, you know, I just couldn't bring myself to do that. You know, I couldn't bring myself to say, well, you know, in classical Buddhist teaching, you know, your son is, you know, in 49 days, he will be moving on to his next life. And, you know, because he was such a good person, he might become a bodhisattva in his next life, you know. I couldn't do it. I couldn't. You know, I'm not criticizing somebody who would do that, but I just couldn't bring myself to do that. You know, I thought, you know, as a Zen person, I could not do that. I couldn't close up that opening like that. Because when those openings happen, they're so priceless. You know, we call Kensho, we have a word in Zen for that. It's called Kensho. You know, so your child has been hit on the highway, your model child, your wonderful son. You know, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody, you know. But when our reality is shattered like that, there's a real chance for us to wake up. And I wasn't trying to use this as a teachable moment, but I was just trying to tell the truth. And I said, you know, the classical Buddhist teaching is blah, blah, blah. And I said, but I don't know. You know, and in fact, nobody knows. And then I said, nothing is going to make this right. You know, nothing is going to make this right for you. There's not a story I can tell. And, you know, I'm probably not a good spiritual advisor, really, you know. They didn't get mad. You know, they were a little surprised. And I said, you know, you loved your son, and, you know, you will always love your son, and he knew you loved him, and he was doing a splendid job with his life, and this is totally unfair, and nothing will make it right. And I said, this will never be right. And I said, you know, with time, it will be less painful. And maybe you can do something with your pain. You know, maybe you could pick up where your son left off with this charity and get involved in it yourself. And then at least you're making something out of your son's death, right? You know, you're doing something with your son's death, and you'll feel better. And she said, thank you for being honest with me. And I never heard of her again, right? But all the same, you know, when we have these moments where there's an interruption or a rupture or a break in our ordinary reality, that's the moment of hope. That's the moment of hope. And you know, and this is not as dramatic as what a little story I just told, which is absolutely true. But Yangshan says, look, you know, Guishan says, look, the illusion is so thorough. The unreality of our world is so invisible to us. It seems so real. How do we ever help people wake up? And Yangshan says, well, you know, it happens all that there are openings all the time. There are opportunities all the time. If a monk comes, you know, if I see a monk in the monastery and he's walking across the courtyard, I'll say, hey, you. If the monk turns his head, I'll say, what is it? And, you know, if he thinks, what the hell? See? Then I say, you know, that's the moment where we can do something. See, that's a moment where it's possible to break through. It's that, he's kind of saying it's that easy, actually. Just push people into confusion, right? Push people in. And he just did it so skillfully. The guy's just walking across the courtyard, this monk. He's probably thinking, when is lunch, right? Yangshan says, hey! And he turns around, it's the master. And Yangshan looks him in the eye and says, what is it? See, and the guy's mind goes blank. He said, what the hell? And Yangshan says, see, that's our chance. That's our chance. If he hesitates, see, once he hesitates, basically, there's a chance that he will discover that he has an active consciousness, boundless and clear, and no fundamental to rely on. See, in other words, yesterday we talked about this, that, you know, Buddhism has some, it's like a medicine that can kill you or cure you. And kill you part is that, you know, Buddhism says, let's be honest, shall we? None of it is real. So, you know, you get your promotion and you think, now I will finally feel like a fully realized human being. And then you get your promotion and go, eh, right? I'm sure, you know, not all children turn out the way the wonderful child of this woman turned out. You know, people think, I'm going to have a child and she's going to be a doctor, and she's going to do this and this. And then you have this kid who won't even talk to you, right? And I think people sometimes have moments where they think, why the hell did I do this, you know? And Buddhism says, don't push that aside, you know? You know, Buddhism comes along and says, you know, all of these things that we thought were so important turn out not to, like, they're all lunchbox, they're all dripping lunchbox moments, right? They're all like the dripping lunchbox. You know, at the time, they seem so real, but, you know, and Buddhism comes along and says that, and some people think, you know, some people hate Buddhism because it does that. But, you know, Buddhism says that's the beginning of real compassion. That's the road of the Bodhisattva. Dare you to walk it. Dare you to admit it to yourself, right? Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him. Hey, you! If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, well, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, but they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. There's hope, right? There's hope. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. It's like, you know, nobody wants to be the child of riches who falls on the boundless road of destitution, but that is the way of Zen. So when you get back from Sesshin, somebody can say, how do you feel? And you can say, I feel like the child of riches who has fallen on destitution. And you can say, isn't it wonderful?